Hi everyone, this is Simone Davis and welcome back to the Montessori Notebook Podcast. This is episode 6 of this season and today it's Q&A day. That sounds a bit weird, doesn't it? But basically, I'm going to be answering all your questions. I do have so many questions that have come in for the, you know, listener questions at the end of each episode. So today I thought that I would just do a solo episode answering a whole bunch of them. And please keep sending them in. I apologize if your question doesn't get answered today. And I will try and do another one of these episodes again soon if you find them helpful. So maybe drop me a note if you want more of these Q&A episodes. I do have some lovely conversations coming up that I can't wait to share with you. Next week, we're going to be talking with Helene, who's based in Portland, and she used to come with her daughter Josie to my classes and what they learned from being in a Montessori playgroup and the things that they're still using in their family. I have conversation with Bill Conway, who's based in Sydney, and he runs a Montessori school there. And so it's really fun to talk to him about how he uses Montessori in the way that he works with his staff and runs the community there. Also, for those of you who always say, you know, it's easy to do Montessori if you've only got one or two children, I'm going to be chatting with Nicole from the Kavanaugh Report. And so she has 4 children and I can't wait to share that conversation. I think you'll all get lots of takeaways from that, as well as a conversation coming up with Juniper, who's based in Nigeria from Enduomo. And I also am looking forward to chatting with my friend Nicole, who is from Radical Beginnings. And it's always so fun to chat with her. Anyway, enough of what's coming ahead and let's get stuck into the question and answers today. I think you'll notice in the way that I answer my questions is that there's no such thing as a silly question. I also just want all of you to realize that we're all doing the best that we can with where we're at. And I hope that that comes across, that, you know, you're all accepted here, no matter what your family makeup or how you parent your child, if you co-sleep or if you choose to have a floor bed or if your child's sleeping in a crib, you know. So please don't feel like I'm going to judge any question. Just send them in and I will do my best to answer them and, you know, say how I would approach it in a Montessori way and really take it or leave it. Okay, so my first question is today from Anka, and she asks, how does Montessori handle night sleep? I have a 12-month-old boy who's in a traditional crib and doesn't sleep through the night. He wakes at least twice and likes to nurse or join my husband and I in our bed. It's been very draining on us. I'm very conflicted about sleep training, and to date, besides the notes on a floor bed, have found very few tips related to sleep training and the Montessori approach. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Anka, thank you very much. And to be honest, there's actually not that much in our Montessori training about sleeping. I think because I was also quite a new parent when I was doing my Montessori training. So I was thinking, great, how do we get children to sleep in their beds in a respectful way? Or, you know, sleeping is such a personal thing, or parenting is such a personal thing. And so there's going to be different approaches for everybody. The one thing that I took away from my training was, you know, we try and also give our children independence in sleeping, but we do that in a very respectful way. So I always like to say, give as much help as necessary, but as little as possible. And the same applies for sleeping. So also you can learn from my mistakes when my son was really small. I was trying to rock him to sleep and I didn't want him to cry. And basically I was burnt out trying to get him to sleep, because even while I was rocking him, he was still crying in my arms. And so we had to find a more peaceful way for him to be in his bed when he fell asleep. Because what happened is when I would rock him to sleep, I'd put him down. And then when he got into light sleep again and my arms weren't there rocking him, he'd look around for me wondering where they were. And like I'd say, it's no different to if you're sleeping at nighttime and your pillow falls off the bed. Then when you get into your light sleep, you're like, hey, where's my pillow? And you have to wake up enough to put the pillow back on your bed and then hopefully fall back to sleep. And that's the same. So if your child falls asleep feeding, or they fall asleep with you rocking them and those kind of things, then sometimes that's why they wake up again during the night, because they're looking for that, you know, situation, you know, the way they fell asleep. And so it's really fine. If you feed to sleep, then that's, you know, also a choice. But just know that, you know, when you stop feeding to sleep, then maybe you will get less night waking, because they won't be looking around for you during the night. And they'll maybe wake up for a short time and then be able to orientate themselves. Yes, this is all the same as it was when I, you know, fell asleep. And then they can put themselves back to sleep. So in our Montessori training, we did talk about floor beds. And floor beds, for those of you who don't know about them, is that from birth, we really start using a floor bed. And that is a place where the child learns, this is my point of reference, this is where I always go to sleep. And so when they're a newborn, they might sleep in a Moses basket on that floor bed. And then as they grow out of the Moses basket, they'll sleep on their bed. And then even when they start to crawl, they'll know, oh, this is actually where I fall to sleep. Your child's in a crib, which is, you know, also a choice, and that's a lot of people will still be using cribs. And we actually used a crib with our children up to around 16 months because my husband at the time wasn't so keen on the approach. We didn't really know much about it and there wasn't much information available. And what we did was then move to a toddler bed a lot sooner. So I don't even think you need a floor bed really much beyond 16 months because they can get in and out of a toddler bed quite easily. And that's the idea, is a floor bed allows the child to, when they wake up, they can crawl out of their bed and they can go over and start playing with a few quiet toys, whatever you have available in your room. Often you can then put a stair gate across the doorway of their room so that they don't start, you know, walking through the whole house, particularly if you have some steep stairs or something that you'd be worried about. And that's the way that Montessori often approaches sleep. So back to your question then, you have a child that wakes up during the night and likes to nurse in the middle of the night and then join your husband or and I in your bed. And so when they wake up to nurse in the night and then get to come into your bed, you can understand that that's probably quite cozy for them. So it's very hard to change those kind of habits, and I completely understand that. And you don't need to, except for the fact that you said it's been very draining on us. And when it's not working then for the whole family, we might need some support to start to change that. So actually, I'm going to, if you get to the point that you want to stop the night feeding, for example, then, you know, it doesn't have to be a terrible thing, but you can just be kind and clear with your child and explain to them that, you know, you won't be feeding during the night. And there may be some transition moments, you know, it sometimes doesn't even take more than a week for them to get real, to realize that there's not going to be milk at night. And you can offer water, and often offering the water means that they're not that interested in waking up instead. I also know one family, for example, who the mum would normally feed during the night, but she fell asleep on the couch in the living room for some reason. And so then the baby didn't wake up, and they decided then for the whole week that she would just sleep on the couch, and the child started sleeping through. So there can be, for some children, really a connection between night feeding and waking up. It's not for everybody, but it's just something to keep in mind that when you do stop night feeding, you might also find that the night waking gets a little bit better as well. If you're interested there's no books on Montessori sleep that I know of, but you can find books that tend to find respectful ways of getting children to sleep. And the one that I recommend usually is called The Sleep Lady's Goodnight Sleep Tide Book by Kim West. And I can put a link to that in the show notes. They're always on the podcast page on my website if you want to find the show notes. You know, basically, she talks about the child falling asleep in their bed. And you sit in a chair next to them and, you know, you give as little help as possible to get them to sleep. And then you can, once they get used to sleeping in their bed, then you can start to move your chair closer to the door. And then eventually you're not in the room when they fall asleep. And then again, usually when they fall asleep in their bed, they tend to not wake up so much at nighttime because when they get into their light sleep, again, they look around and they recognize their situation. So I think that's everything that I wanted to say about that. I guess also to do something to do with Montessori is that at a point we don't use nursing for comfort, we're really using nursing for nutrition. And so there's other ways that you can comfort your child that is like, yeah, I give you a hug, just as a father would give a hug to their child to help them calm down. We don't just automatically nurse a child. So it's really then about deciding when you're going to be feeding your child, and then they get very clear on that as well. So there was a point where I was just feeding my children just in the morning and just in the evening, and we didn't nurse during the night, but we were still, you know, breastfeeding twice a day. Anyway, I hope that's helpful. It's not easy, and you also might want to speak with a sleep consultant. Generally, the sleep consultants don't tell you much different than what I'm saying now, which is also to just be super consistent with what you try to do. Oh, that's one thing I didn't mention, is that like in the middle of the night, it's really hard to decide what you do. And so sometimes you feed them, they come into bed. Sometimes you feed them and you say, no, I really want them to sleep in their crib tonight. And we're quite inconsistent. So just as we have a consistent bedtime routine, also decide with your partner, what are we going to do when they wake up? Because at 2 o'clock in the morning, it's not the time to decide. And then if you find you can be more consistent, then that helps the child also know what the cues are. And anyway, the sleep consultant can often hold you to what you say, what you want to achieve. And most of them will be very, very respectful and not have to leave your child to cry. And also, you know, maybe your child will be crying a little bit while you're sitting next to them in the crib. But sometimes I find that even if I was holding them, they'd still be crying. And so, you know, people may disagree with me, but I don't think you're doing anything wrong by saying to your child, I see that you're having a hard time sleeping and I'm here. Yeah. Okay. So our next question is from DT, and she says, my child is 14 months old. My husband and I have 8 hours of office working from Monday to Friday, excluding daily travel time. Please suggest tips for working parents for managing kid. I'm scared of daycare and I feel guilty that if we put him in daycare so early, it will be a bad experience for him. So DT, I definitely think you need to go back and listen to episode 2 with Trina from DIY Corporate Mum. She had so many beautiful things to share about, you know, being a working parent. And I think you'll get a lot of takeaways. She talks about respectfully saying goodbye to her child. And also what I love about Trina is she's choosing to work, but also then when she's choosing to be with her family, she really shows up for her family. And I think that that's one thing about Montessori, is that presence when you're with your child. So you put away your phones because you know that once they're in bed, you know, you'll be able to, you know, check your email and catch up with Instagram or whatever you need to do on your telephone. And then there is still a lot of time that you are together. It really makes, you know, breakfast time, eating together, perhaps even more special, because that is your moment of connection. Meal times, you know, in the evening, you might want to be really practical and have some things that are already prepared so that you only have to warm up your meals. So maybe make and prep meals on the weekends, and so that during the week it can either be a very simple meal, like we're really just going to have the basics during the week, or it might be that you prepare something, you know, a stew or some soups or something like that that is in your freezer that you only need to reheat, so that then when you're at home you can really focus on the evening routine and being with your children. And what I also say to working parents, myself included, is that, you know, when I come in, I try to sit down and connect first with the children, as opposed to thinking I need to get started with dinner. Because then when you fill up their bucket, and you then tend to find that you have more patience and more connection as the evening goes on than when we kind of rush through things. Your children want to see you and they want to connect with you. I also always love inviting children into the kitchen to help me. And maybe if that's new to you, you know, you might not have so much patience at the end of a workday. So I would then say to start on weekends to, you know, involve them in some of the food preparation, setting the table and all those kind of things. And then you can maybe add that more into your weekly routine as well. You know, I think daycare is such a personal thing, and I would look for somewhere where you find that the staff are very respectful to the children, where there's some interesting activities to keep them stimulated, that it's really like a home away from home. That's what you're really looking for with young children, is that it feels like a safe place. It doesn't mean that you have to have a child that is easy to go with anyone. You just need to find, you know, a daycare or nursery that has someone that you really feel safe with, because if you have any doubts about them going to daycare or the place that you've chosen, your child will pick it up definitely, and it will definitely be more difficult. But working parents is a reality, and there are many places that are supportive of working parents and will also, you know, they're trained, they have great insights into children and children's development, and so you may actually find a really lovely place where your child would be happy as well. But go at your own pace, because as I say, your children pick up when you feel comfortable with things or not. Things are definitely slower when we do it the Montessori way, at least initially. You know, taking the time, slowing down to their pace and getting them involved. So recognize that if you're feeling rushed, that it's better maybe to say, oh, you really want to help with the dinner and I can see that I'm getting stressed right now. Let's write it on the calendar so we remember that we'll do that together. And your child's only 14 months old, but at the same time, they really pick up everything that we say. They understand it all. They maybe just can't say it back. So you can talk them through those things as well. So DT, definitely go back and listen to episode 2. I think you'll get the most out of that conversation with Trina. Okay, Caroline asks, she has a toddler who's 22 months old and she wants discipline advice for aggressive behavior. For example, pulling hair, pinching without spanking, and how to convince other family members that this is a better method than spanking. We restrain her arms and use a calm, stern voice and say, no pinching. Is that enough? And then she has a question about homeschool. Okay. Thank you, Caroline, for your question. Discipline. I love talking about discipline because I think there's a lot of, not confusion, but you know, we only know how we were raised ourselves. And if you were spanked or threatened, you know, to get your compliance, then, you know, we tend to replicate these things until we question them and see is there a different way and how can we still, you know, get some cooperation, or we don't want them to become naughty kids. We don't want them to end up in jail. You know, we want them to be able to behave, but at the same time, you know, spanking is now, you know, not a respectful way to be with a person. I mean, basically, if you spank your child, then you're saying it's okay to hit. And that's actually the behavior that we are trying to avoid and trying to tell them that it's not okay, that it's not appropriate. Let's go back to the word discipline anyway, in any case. And I always, in my How to Talk So Kids Will Listen workshops, we talk about that discipline actually comes from the word disciple, which means to teach or to learn. And actually, I think these days, discipline is about how we punish our kids and spank them or we threaten them, you know, so we can get them to do what they're told. And actually, when we think of like, okay, they've pulled my hair, but actually, how can we teach them something right now? How can they learn something from this? It actually means that, well, we don't have to say, yay, there's a terrible thing that's happened, but we can actually see that even from a negative situation, we can get our child to benefit and to learn from the situation as well, and we're able to teach them in that moment. So the Montessori approach to discipline is a long-term approach. It means that you may not get immediate compliance. They may not sit in timeout, for example. Like, we don't believe in timeout either, because that means that when a child's misbehaved and we isolate them, when they're actually really often wanting connection, they pull our hair because they want attention, or they pull our hair because they're saying something didn't go our way. And actually then we can say, okay, I'm not going to let you pull your hair. I'm not going to let you pull my hair, sorry. And, you know, particularly if you're holding them, then you say, I'm going to put you down. Yeah, I really don't like having my hair pulled. It really hurts me. And so you're very clear, like, I'm not going to let you do that. You're basically teaching children how to show boundaries with people, because it's not okay for people to cross your boundaries. If they're pinching you, again, you can say, ow, that hurts. I'm not going to let you pinch me. You know, you're upset about something. Come and show me over here on this paper, and they can draw an angry picture over here. Or let's pinch this clay if you need to, you know, squeeze something right now. I'd also be really careful about using gentle hands. So for example, when you say that we restrain her arms, she might think that, well, I'm just restraining your arms, but it's a pinch, you know? And so there's some miscommunication. So if I ever need to handle a child, I often say to myself, to remind myself, like, I'm using my gentle hands to move you over here, so that they see that actually we always handle them with respect, and that we don't, you know, give them permission to hit someone, pull their hair, or pinch someone, biting, any of these things. It's the same thing. I'm really kind and clear. So I think there is a misconception that in Montessori, we let children do whatever they like. And if they misbehave, that, you know, we either ignore that behavior or we let them get away with it. But the way that you often can convince family members or show them that how you approach discipline is that you're kind and clear. You tell them that it's not okay. And, you know, they can also make it up to you. They learn how to make amends. So if they've hurt you and once everyone's calmed down, then you can say, you know, that really hurt when you pulled my hair. You know, could you give me a little massage? Or, you know, I've got a little tear here. Let's go and get a tissue. And so you can actually show them that it's restorative justice. It's making it right with someone that you've done something wrong to. And I think that that's maybe why Montessori there's that misconception, is because people forget to do that step of helping their child then learn and make amends. And with, you know, a 22-month-old, you're mostly doing a modeling process in that moment. They won't often spontaneously go over, but when you keep doing this, and that's the other thing, is that it's a long-term approach, because you're going to need to be kind and clear over and over again. Yeah, you know, remember that hurt, mummy. I really don't like it when you pull my hair, you know? So you're going to have to be kind and clear and repeat it often. And so choose limits that you're okay to repeat and repeat. It's not that they've forgotten. It's just that they have a developing prefrontal cortex and that they need reminders that they've forgotten the rule in that moment, or they really want to pull. Like, I mean, at the moment, my hair's in a plait and it probably would be quite enticing for a toddler to like, let me pull this and see what happens. But it's actually attached to my head, so it's going to hurt me. So I hope that it's a very short introduction to discipline. It's convincing family, it's often translating for them. Oh, like, you're really worried that I'm letting her get away with it, and I'm teaching her that we don't hurt mummy and that we can make it up to her. Yeah, I guess some people might say, yes, you'll actually get more, like a quicker result if you stick them in timeout or spank them. You know, they really deserve a smack. You know, if you're at that point where you are going to smack your child, give them a spanking, then you actually are the one that needs to model taking a break. You know, I'm so upset right now, I need to go and make myself a cup of tea. I can't be around you right now. And if you have a partner, maybe that's the time that they step in so that you don't get to the point where you're exploding and need to spank a child. I think you can always do it in a kind and clear way. Okay. And then you had a question about my thoughts on Montessori and homeschooling. I'm looking into doing more of a co-op homeschool program instead of public school. I live in the US. So Caroline, I actually don't have any personal experience with homeschooling. I have friends who have homeschooled, and I think that it can be a great option for kids, particularly if you can't find a school that meets the needs of your child. I think that some people need then to maybe do a Montessori training if they're planning to homeschool their children, or you might find an online curriculum. Really, if you put into Google Montessori homeschooling, you'll find some great curriculums. I know Child of the Redwoods has one, and other online programs. So I haven't got any experience with any of them, so it's really maybe just look around for some of those, and I hope that helps. I just thought of one last thing about the discipline thing, which I didn't touch on. And that is like, try and think back to when you were a kid, and if someone shouted at you, or they threatened you, or they spanked you, did you actually have more respect for that person? Did you feel connected to that person? Usually, if I ask people, they say that they feel angry at them. And actually, I know myself, the one time I got a detention at school, I was so, you know, upset that I was telling everybody how mean the teacher was for giving me the detention. And I wasn't even, you know, sorry for what I'd done wrong. So often it doesn't teach us anything in the end. And when you actually get children to take responsibility for what they did wrong, then they actually learn from the situation. And the next time, we hope that they're going to behave in a different way. And again, with toddlers, a 22-month-old, you'll need to repeat these lessons again and again until they become automatic. Okay. Francis asks about living a Montessori life with multiple children. For example, 18-month-old, 3-year-old, and a 5-year-old. And exactly, yeah, having multiple children means that we're trying to meet the needs of all of the children, and they all have different needs, likely when you have different age groups. But it's also what I really like, the idea that Michael Gross has in his book Thriving. And again, I'll put the link to any of the books and things that I mention in today's episode in the show notes. But he talks about being like pretend actually to have a big family, like you have 4 children, because then you can't be busy with, you know, all of the tiny things that happen, and you're more seeing the culture of the family. So what kind of values do you want your family to have? And that's kind of what our role becomes. Sometimes people understand it when I say, like, imagine you're the CEO of a company. The CEO can't be the one that takes the orders and calls the wholesalers and does all that work, but they can set the culture of how everyone does that without having to, you know what's happening at every single phone call that and they're having people report back into them. So you're basically being the guide. That's a Montessori term, isn't it? That we're our family's guide in this situation. So I think that's one thing that I would say back is, like, just because we have 3 children doesn't mean that we have to be able to step in for every single situation. And how can I guide my family? I also can't wait to share my interview later in this season with Nicole Kavanagh, because she talks about how if she's busy with something and another child needs help, how she handles it. And basically, if I remember correctly, it's kind of like she might even get one of the other children to help. Like, oh, could you help your younger brother get a drink of water if they need help? So it's a bit like having your own Montessori classroom where older children can help younger children. And the younger children are going to learn so much from the older children. So instead of feeling guilty that we can't, you know, have the one-on-one time that we used to have just when we had one or even two children, you know that they're absorbing from the whole family. So they're learning so much from not just us, but the other children in the family as well. So that might hopefully help some of the cultural shifts, you know, how we, the big parenting, big picture parenting part of it. And then look at the physical setup as well. So how can we use our environment to do some of the work for us as well? So how can the 18-month-old get their things, the 3-year-old manage theirs, and the 5-year-old manage their own things? So at the front door, again, that just might mean that there's this place for everyone to be able to hang up their bag, hang up their coat, and everyone can find their own things. It can be in the kitchen that everyone, again, can help themselves to set the table and be involved and taking part in the family. And then with toys and things, it's probably very important then to have an idea of how you're going to share the toys in your house. So even though there is an age span, I think the younger ones are just as interested in playing with the toys that the 5-year-olds are playing with. And so finding a way, is it going to be like you have in a Montessori classroom where you share by taking turns? Or is it that, you know, the older one has their toys and the younger ones have to ask permission? But as long as you make it consistent, and I think either can work. For me, I just found it easier to have everyone in our house all have access to the same toys. And I guess also I wanted to just say that even though there are 3 children, each of them are going to have 3 different personalities. What I found, even just having 2 children, is yes, my children were raised in our house and we share some similar values, but both of them are so different in many other ways. And so just remembering to treat each child individually and to really show them what we value about them as a person. So hopefully then they feel seen. And, you know, it may even be that you can make a special one-on-one time, a little date with each of them at different times. I know some families have, as they get a little older, you know, go on holidays with just one child and have a special weekend away. So that can be really something to think about for the future as well. Tanya asks, her 1-year-old, does my son need his own space to brush his teeth and wash his hands, or can he use my sink but just use a step stool? So Tanya, when my children were much smaller, they're now 17 and 19, indeed, we just used a step stool and they would be able to reach their toothbrush and we'd help if we needed to, you know, to bring things a little bit closer, but trying to give them as much independence as possible. And I know, like on Instagram, you can see some beautiful self-care setups, and it's really lovely if you have space, you know, to have an area where they can have their things down low and a mirror down low, and even maybe a bowl that they use so that they can brush their teeth so they can be independent. But it's really up to you and how much space you have in your bathroom. And I wouldn't go out and buy a lot of extra things, but maybe if you have a table that you can reuse, or that you bring a table in from time to time. I think if they're not showing any resistance to teeth brushing, they're already able to climb up on the step, they can reach the water okay, I'd stick with the step stool. I'm not really about buying lots and lots of stuff. Making it super practical is also part of Montessori and making it, you know, affordable and very low key. Yeah, so it's really up to you, Tanya, I would say, for that one. Caitlin asks, will there ever be a time as a teacher that I won't have to prove my knowledge or reasoning within my classroom? I feel like I'm constantly in a weird battle with non-Montessori admin of why I do what I do in my room. Or is it that I'll gain confidence over time and admin's snarky directions will have less effect on me? And I really like this question, Caitlin, because even if you're not a Montessori teacher, I'm sure that some people, as a Montessori parent, you may have had someone comment on the way that you parent things and you feel like you have to justify yourself in some way. But I would be really open to just keep showing up and modeling the respectful way that you want to be with the children. You could invite them to come and observe in your classroom so they have a better understanding of the Montessori approach and what you're trying to achieve. So I'm assuming that maybe you get into battles because an administrator might, I guess, need to pay for some of the things that you're asking for. It might be nice for you to then, rather than have to question every purchase, you could maybe then agree what your budget will be, and then you can be creative about how you make it yourself. So it's kind of like, why don't you also look at the administrator a bit like your partner? Like, what are their needs and what are my needs, and how can we both have our needs met? What's important for you is that you want to be able to execute your classroom as much as possible, and they need to be able to make sure that the budget, you know, is met. Or it might be something to do with teacher ratio or something like this. But it's like, if we actually go into a conversation with them, and when they start shouting at us, we can kind of actually empathize with them and ask back, you know, okay, can you tell me more about that? I'm really wanting to understand why, you know, that's important to you. And you actually might find that they will be open to telling you, and you might say, oh, I thought you were just giving me a snarky direction because blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, I think these open conversations can help. And then if not, if you're really finding that they're closed to everything you're saying, then I think you're right. I think the more confident you get and you keep showing up in the classroom and being the best teacher you can be and the best guide, they'll see the power of the work, the parents that are happy. And I think that you will feel less intimidated or less, you know, these comments might wash off your back quite easily. I feel like the more that we embrace who we are, people are less worried about it. You know, like, I'm separated, I don't have a husband, but I'm really okay with it. So when I first told people, people were like, oh, I'm sorry. I'm like, oh, no, it's a good thing, you know. And if you want to hear about our co-parenting arrangement, you can go back to episode 1 and listen to Luke and I talk about it. And it's a really positive thing. You know, the more that you're just okay with it, people are okay with your situation as well. So just to say that I think that, you know, the less you're trying to prove yourself and feel that they need to understand, I think they're actually probably going to accept you even more. And yeah, I would try, if you can, to work towards building a team with them, being respectful. And yeah, I hope that helps, Caitlin. Maybe you can even, you know, give them a copy of The Montessori Toddler if you work with toddlers, or even if you don't, it's got some really easy, accessible information for people to understand the Montessori approach. And, you know, even just reading the first chapter, a lot of people say it really shifted their perspectives. Like, it's a real paradigm shift how we're seeing the toddler and the child, and not as, you know, naughty or frustrated, but like, we're seeing how capable they are and how we can set up our environment to nurture that. So maybe they'd just like to read the first chapter and see if that resonates for them as well. Okay, Tony asks, my in-laws gifted my 2.5 son Nerf guns this past Christmas. So Nerf guns, for those people who don't know, are like a toy gun that shoots out some soft foam bullets. I'm not a fan of him playing with a toy that imitates or suggests violence. How should I proceed? Or should I relax and let him play with his gift? So Tony, I'm a bit with you. At 2.5, I also don't like any guns because they're in the absorbent mind and they don't know if this is bad or good. You know, more for the elementary child from 6 to 12, there's a really interesting article on the mariamontessori.com website, which I'll link to in the show notes, called Boys and Gunplay. And it talks about how children at that age are playing with power a little bit. And so they might want to pretend to play with a gun, but they also can use a rock. They can make mud balls and snowballs and mud pies. And there's lots of examples. Also, one of the comments to that article, if you scroll right down, talks about how the sound of a toy gun, you know, could be interesting. And so they can meet that need instead by doing scientific experiments, for example, like volcanic explosions and those kind of things. And, you know, some people also might say that water pistols still look too much like a gun. And so there's now like water rockets that you can find so that they get that need to kind of like, yeah, express some of that, but without a gunplay. I mean, what I also found is we all never had guns in our house. It was something that I didn't feel comfortable with either. And my son went through a little stage with his friend where they'd run around with sticks, you know, and I'd rather that be the case, that they're kind of trying it out, but that I'm not actually putting something in their hands that they're trying out. So, I mean, I think it's such a personal thing again. Even tools, like if they're attracted to shiny objects, Nerf guns aren't particularly shiny, but guns in general are shiny, then, you know, tools can also meet their need. But I really think that it's more for an elementary age child, like above 6, you know, when they're trying out these things. And then again, not guns, but other ways of trying this power play would be more appropriate, in my opinion. So I would just, yeah, maybe say, oh, thanks very much for your gift. And we'll try that out another time, maybe quite a few years later. And then when you can, you know, discuss that, why it's not okay to point a gun at somebody and how we can play with it more appropriately or not use it at all. Yeah. So that's a interesting one. I think the article will really help people if they've got questions about gunplay. Lizzie asks, my almost 3-year-old daughter attends a Montessori preschool 3 days a week. The other twin, she is home with me. The other twin? The other days. I'm not sure now. I struggle with creating and keeping to a routine for her home days. Ah, I see. Okay. I think it's not a twin. I think it's meant to say the other days she's home with me. What's the Montessori approach to structure a day at home that balances her needs with mine, i.e. getting at least one chore done around the house? And I'm laughing because I think probably everyone can relate to that. When my children were small, they also had like a half day of preschool when they were 3 years old. And then in the afternoon, we'd do something together. So I actually, having a rhythm in the day that children know what's coming next. Go again back to episode 3 and listen to Eloise's day is really nice to hear. For us, it was very simple. We'd wake up and we'd, have a very quiet, we often loved reading books. So we'd end up in bed reading books together. Then we'd, have breakfast, we'd get dressed. We often used to go out in the morning to do something, like we did volunteer work at a nursing home. I'd go and visit my family sometimes. We went to a Montessori playgroup once a week, and things like this. So that was, when we had a full day. This was when they were actually not a preschool yet, but you get the idea, is that you can have an outing in the morning and then you come back and you have lunch together. You might have nap time or a quiet time. And then usually in the afternoon, we had no plans, which would just be, playing at home, or we'd head out to the playground or to a park or for a walk. And then by 5 o'clock, we'd be getting ready for dinner and then have an early dinner, bath, bed routine. And the day would kind of go like that. And it was always this predictable flow, is that in the morning, kind of an outing, lunch, nap, or quiet time, and then into the day. And then, when they were in preschool, we had 5 mornings and 3 afternoons. And so then we might organize one of those that it was a play date with a friend. And, a little bit of structure, but not so much structure. So that there was still a lot of long, slow days, and lots of time to enjoy each other still. I think also to get our things done, it's a very Montessori thing, practical life skills, is getting them involved in what needs to be done. So when they're having free play, I think I can also go and get something done in the other room. And if they want you to come back to play, you say, oh, I'm going to put on a load of washing now. Would you like to come and help me? And so my children pretty much just came along and helped me put on washing machines, or they'd help me prepare some food. So yeah, I definitely didn't always give in to what they needed me to do right in that moment. It's really okay to say, oh, I'm working on this. Would you like to do it with me? And, 50% of times they might help, and 50% of times they might keep playing. So it's gradually, being okay with it. I think, again, like the more confident, calm and clear we are, then they also pick up that we're not being, wishy-washy, and we can actually get something done too. I think something like sitting down to do email is probably more difficult. So, something like that I might do in a nap time or after, in the evenings, unless it's something really urgent. And then it's going to be, I have an urgent email. We need to organize for someone to come and fix something at house. And you could, again, explain what you're typing so that they understand why. If you need to check your phone during the day, I would be like, oh, I'm opening up my phone because I need to call such and such. Or, there's a message. Let's see who it is. So rather than them thinking that you're just sitting on your phone, they actually also get an idea of how you use your phone and how you get your things done. But yeah, I think being present most of the time, and then occasionally you can do your things. And I always invite them to join me. And I got a few things done, and a few things after hours as well. I really, hats off to parents who can work at home and have children playing. I have no advice there, because I really can't do two things at once. Like, those two roles to me are really difficult to juggle. Okay, Lisa asks, how to display Lego Duplo the Montessori way? My son, 18 months, is starting to play with Duplo, the bigger Lego blocks. We have them in a big cardboard or plastic box, so we need to rummage through to find stuff. It's the way everyone I know stores their Lego. I like the blocks because you can be creative in what you do with them, but unhappy with the storage solution. Do you know a better way? Thanks, Lisa. She also said, love your book. So I also will admit that one of the activities that was on our shelves was often like a Duplo or a Lego set as they got older, with the smaller blocks. And I think the thing that made it possible, like you do rummage around a little bit with Lego as well, is to look at how many pieces do you have out. So with an 18-month-old, you probably actually don't need as many pieces as you think. So it's always like, I was actually at a friend's place and she was like, what is this with Duplo? And she ended up taking away 3/4 of it and just leaving out a small amount. And all of a sudden the kids were playing with it much more, rather than just kind of being empty out all the time. So I'd look at first the quantity, and then you can rotate it. So some Duplo, for example, have some animals and some of them are just loose blocks. But if you've got animals and then you could rotate it for a different set, then you might find that they get more interest as well. So that can make it more interesting. I'm not one to spend so much time sorting Lego, but if you were interested in, actually being able to find pieces, then you could use something like the IKEA drawers. I think they're called Moppe, M-O-P-P-E. And then you could put all of the blue ones in this one and all of the red ones in this one and all the yellow here and the bigger ones in a different box. But at 18 months, I think you're going to have more success with them just getting it back into a basket or a box. Just look at the size of the container that you're putting it in, and am I okay with cleaning all of that up? Another thing that can really help with Lego, because everyone I know has trodden on some Lego, is to have a mat that you roll out when you're playing with, you know, blocks and those kind of things. And that marks the area where the pieces stay in. And this is nice even if you've got older children as well, because, if someone's building something and they don't want anyone else to touch their construction, the mat will mark their workspace, just like in a Montessori classroom. So you can roll out a mat and then all the pieces stay on there. I've also seen these pack and go, I think they're called. And they're basically, I'll put a link to one of them in the show notes. And it's a piece of material that has a drawsting kind of thing. So you open it up and it actually creates the place where they play. And then you pull the string tight and it pulls all the Lego in and you store it in that bag. I'm not sure if I'm explaining it very clearly, but they might also be quite useful, you know, so that actually everything lays flat rather than being deep into a bucket, which actually makes me think at 18 months, it might actually be better to have like a lower basket, something with not such a big side on it, so they can really see all the pieces that are available. And I think like as they get older, we then just had one Lego set out at a time. So for example, there's a Lego set that would be bit for building a house. And then we might rotate that with one that's for building a fun fair or something like that. And I found that then the children were very excited to see a different set come out, as well as just having, you know, the opportunity to play with Lego in any way without following any set at all. I hope that gives you a few ideas for Lego storage. And, you know, it's not a Montessori material, but I love Lego as well. So many creative possibilities, and there's a bit of maths involved if you really want to have everything educational. Elizabeth asks, my 25-month-old just started attending a Montessori preschool. We've been a Montessori family from the start, and I noticed we have several duplicate materials to her classroom. How can we choose good toys and activities for her use at home that don't duplicate her work at school? So Elizabeth, I think this is really interesting because particularly from 3 years old when they start preschool and they start getting into the sensorial materials with like cylinder blocks and red rods and pink towers, I definitely don't think you need any of those Montessori materials at home at all. Under three, I think that they're at preschool probably only a few hours a day. So it may be that you have a few toys that are similar, you know, because if they're practicing threading in the classroom, often they're practicing threading at home. This is something that they're really working to master. So it might be that you have something similar to, but not exactly the same one as. But basically what I say is that once they're in a Montessori school, preschool, you know, daycare, something like this, is to think about more like practical life skills. So involving them in our daily lives, the setting the table, the cooking with them, baking, how they dress themselves, and all of those things are opportunities for having Montessori at home that aren't, you know, classroom materials. Heading outdoors, there's so much opportunity to walk, hike, swing, bike ride, jump, all of those kind of movement things, gardening, sweeping, cleaning windows. So a lot of those heading outdoors activities. You might find that you're starting to play some board games or some simple memory games. And I love board games as they get bigger, you know, really simple ones like Shopping List is a really one that I love. And then there's another one called Orchard. So they might be eventually something that you move into that's not really like a Montessori activity that you'd find in the classroom. Art and craft, I think, is brilliant because you can do so much self-expression. You know, children that are toddlers, they need to express themselves. And so having beautiful, simple art materials, good quality art is another way. So I wouldn't necessarily have exactly the same activities as they have there, but, you know, some simple crayons at home or at school, I think that's going to be, you know, okay if there's a little bit of overlap in those things. Making music, I think that, again, even though they have musical instruments in their classroom, I would have musical instruments at home, a dancing mat, a little CD player that they can play music and dance. Maybe some more open-ended toys like the Lego or some of the rainbow arches, building and exploring, you know, just loose parts. I always loved making nature collections with my children. So every time we'd go out on a hike, we call them bushwalks in Australia, then we'd always come back with rocks and sticks and things for our collection, and then you can have loose parts play when you get home as well. One thing I also really enjoyed, which isn't a particularly Montessori activity that you find in the classroom, is building marble runs. And you can do this from anything from like using toilet rolls along the wall to, you know, some of the nice wooden marble runs. And my kids had one that my parents gave them that was plastic, and I still have it. It's because they can actually construct it themselves, and, you know, marble runs for days in our house. What else would there be? Reading books, language opportunities. So in the classroom, you might have the vocabulary baskets and matching to pictures, and maybe at home, so that it's not exactly the same as what they find at school. You know, it's very natural for kids. They have a giraffe, and then you're reading about a giraffe, so they run over and they get the giraffe out of the basket of African animals, and they match it that way. Yeah, reading books and going to the library, which is actually also another thing, like you can take the opportunity to go out and do little expeditions and visits places. But the library was always a favorite for ours. Or you can, like we said before, visit a nursing home. Just there's so many things I think you can do that won't duplicate what's in the classroom. And what I really also love is that you can get into their deep interests. So if your child's fascinated by vehicles, it gives you an opportunity to do visits to a train museum, or to go and watch a building site. Or I think I've mentioned before that we would go and watch the trains come in at the train station. There was a bridge over the top near my parents' house, and we'd sit at the top and see how many of the train drivers could wave at us. So you can go into their deep interests when you're at home and do activities around those things. Don't also forget that toddlers love to move. So we talked about going outside and those kind of things, but maximum effort. So giving them really heavy things to move is also really brilliant. So you can kind of be creative, but just involving them in going to the supermarket and daily life. I think that's a lot of activities. Hopefully that helps, Elizabeth. Yeah. Okay, the next one is from Anonymous, which is also fine if you want to send in a question. You don't have to have your name read out at all. Her first question is, how can I maintain my one-year-old's interest and concentration when modeling an activity or task? For example, in showing her a simple knobbed puzzle, she'll just take the knobbed piece, stand up, and walk away with it. So, yes, exactly. At 1 year old, that's what they're often doing. They're practicing their fine and gross motor skills. So the fine motor is picking out the puzzle piece in different ways. So the way that I would then maybe encourage their concentration is that I would, once they've taken them all out, I'd say, oh, look, I'll put them back in for you, so that they can repeat it, and then they can take the pieces out again and put them back in. And then gradually over time, you might see, particularly if you start with circular shapes, they might just slide back in by accident at first and then more regularly. So concentration for one-year-olds is basically a one-step activity. And right now, she's taking the puzzle piece out. You might see, like, if you have threading rings onto a peg, they'll take them off the pegs, and then I'll put them back on, and then she'll take them off again, and then one day she'll get them back on. So it's basically, in one way for toddlers, we tend to undo an activity and have it presented on the shelf so that they can, it's like, yeah, if a puzzle's already complete, they may not be interested. But so some people take the puzzle pieces out, but it'd almost be the opposite for a one-year-old who is practicing taking pieces out, and then we put them back in for them. So I think that your child's completely in line with what most one-year-olds would be doing, and then just follow their interests. As their concentration increases, you can start to add more steps to some of the things that they're working on. And then the second question is, my one-year-old likes to flip the pages of board books, so I let her practice alone because that's clearly her current interest. However, with books that have flaps, she sometimes rips them accidentally, or by being too forceful, or because she's discovered she can. How could I address treating books and other things with care? Yeah, I love reading books with one-year-olds because it's hilarious. Like you say, she's just turning the pages, and I love seeing a parent who isn't following their child in a way, because they're really wanting to read the book from the first page to the last page. And then they actually learn, once they're following their child, oh, actually, they don't really care about the story right now. So when the child opens it up to page 5, even if they haven't read pages 1 to 4 before, it's just like, oh, and I see there's an elephant, the elephant's in the zoo. And they can talk about what they see on the page rather than following necessarily the order. But we, for children under three, there's an absorbent mind, an unconscious absorbent mind. So rather than giving them a lesson about treating books carefully, they watch how we do it. So in our Montessori training, we actually had a presentation about reading a book, and you show them how you very carefully pick up the corner and how you slowly turn the page and how you then maybe smooth it down on the other side. And we take it for granted that everyone knows how to turn pages, but actually it's again about slowing down so that the children can see how gently and respectfully we turn the pages. Around 1 year old, I often use board books because they're not, you know, their movements are just so raw and big and they're not so careful. And then as you see that they're getting more skilled, then I might move to paper books, you know, the thinner pages. And with flap books, yeah, around 1 year old, 1 year old, the children love the flaps. If it's an accident, then I would say, oh, look, it ripped. Let's go and get some tape and we'll put it back on. But if they're just sitting there ripping them all off, then I would step in and say, oh, it looks like you're really interested in tearing these flaps off. This is our book and we're very gentle with books. Let's put this one away for later. And I might just put it away for a couple of weeks and then try it again in a couple of times later. I mean, if you've got some old newspaper, maybe then you could get into a tearing activity instead, because they're saying, like, I really am interested in how a flap tears, but I'm not going to let them, you know. And so that's also about Montessori. It's not just letting your child do whatever you want. You can also respect the books, and you're showing them that we respect books by removing it, saying, oh, I'm sorry, we're gentle with books and I'm going to put that away for now. So slow down. Also just notice how to be gentle with things in general. Like often unconsciously, we push in a chair with our foot. We sit on a table because it's down low, and we are actually modeling how to use furniture in those situations. So it's about actually having less in our hands, because sometimes I'm walking around the classroom and I've got three different activities and I'm looking, thinking, actually, I'm not modeling this for the children very well at all. Yes, it's quicker for me to pack it away this way, but in the long run, I'm better off carrying a small amount, just like a child would be able to. So I'm showing them how that they treat things gently as well. Okay, how are you all doing? I've got a few more that I'm going to answer. I hope that's okay. And yes, we'll definitely have to come back to these Q&As. There's so many good questions here. And like, I'm just answering all of them because I think you will, even if that situation doesn't apply to you right now, there's definitely the whole idea of Montessori coming through, right? I think so anyway. So Sheila asks, my son is 2 years old now and we started Montessori at home when he was 20 months old. I saw a big change and the beauty of Montessori that transformed my child into a curious one. I practice the positive discipline approach, but my husband doesn't participate. He has his own views about parenting, which I respect his fear, an authoritarian approach because he was raised that way. I keep reminding him about the Montessori approach and discipline, but he still uses bribes, punishments, and rewards. How can I convince my husband to listen and stop those nonsense if he wants our son to become a respectful human being? Please help. Thank you. Okay, yes, Sheila, it is difficult when you have different approaches to your partner. I think that in the big picture, we would love to, I understand that everyone has a different, you know, style of parenting, but the big picture things, we'd love to be on the same page. So I think it's an ongoing conversation. I think that you're starting in the right place, like maybe with the activities, and you see how much more curious your child is. Then I keep modeling them and these things, and they see, hey, how come he listens to you, for example, or why don't they respect me? I mean, or when they say, mummy, you do it, and they don't choose him, then he might be open to more conversations about, okay, maybe that's they're actually enjoying the way that I'm stopping to listen, that I want to work with them to get things done, to get their cooperation, as opposed to just giving a string of instructions or threatening them. Because like we talked about earlier in the episode, when you threaten or bribe, these are all kind of extrinsic to the child. So you might get their cooperation in the moment, but actually you're not building the intrinsic motivation about doing it because it makes someone else feel good or it's what someone else wants, which is what the aim of Montessori and these kind of positive discipline approaches are trying to work on. So again, you can give the example of like, what did it feel like to you when you were punished at home? Did you, even though you were raised that way, is that something that you respected your parents for? I think sometimes what people respect is that at least their parents were clear. And I think that's what we can give, even in the Montessori approach, is being kind and clear. you can have a conversation. Like, what are you worried about? Like, if I do it this way, what are you worried is going to happen? And maybe they're worried that, yeah, they're getting away with too much, or that they have to learn to do some things. And so then you can say, it's not that I'm avoiding that, but I'm not interrupting the activity. And then we're going to change their nappy. Not that I'm never going to change their diaper at all. So I think there's room for a conversation. Also, when you say, how can I convince my husband to listen and stop those nonsense if he wants our son to become a respectful human being? When you say nonsense, it also sounds a little bit like you're not respectful to his views. And I, in my opinion, everyone is right in their own head. You know, we're all doing our best when he's not trying to be a strict parent, because that winds you up. He's doing being a strict parent because he really thinks that that's going to be the best for his child. So I think it's also coming to not attack people, but come with curiosity. Like, I'm really wanting to learn more. Can you tell me about? Yeah. And I think that then you're also modeling to your child, I may not agree with what your father says, but I'm really curious about why he finds that important. You can also translate, because sometimes I think that, you know, a strict parent might get really in the head, like that this has to happen right now. And then the child's melting down, and we can translate for each of the parties involved, including the parent who is maybe getting angry and shouting at this child. And we say, it sounds like it's really important to dad that you sit at the table to eat, you know, and it sounds like you really want to get up and we eat at the table. So you can kind of translate it into a way that the child might hear more than their father, you know, disciplining that way. And then you actually supporting both parties. You're not saying, because often sometimes what happens is we don't say no to our child, but then we start, you know, nagging at the parents, like, you shouldn't say this. And so we end up nagging the parent, the other partner, in a way that we wouldn't even speak to the child. So it's something to think about. I don't know. I hope that's useful, that start to see how you can also work with your partner and start the conversation. And if nothing else, just keep being the example. And kids are pretty clever. They work out, like, if I want empathy right now, I'm maybe going to go to my mother. And then when I want to do some rough play and some other fun stuff, and that's what my dad really enjoys, then I'll go to him. So that's what happens kind of in our house anyway. Like, I'm definitely the one that's happy to listen to anything. And Luke is very funny, and the kids can go and hang out with him when they want to laugh. Oh, so you've got one more question, Sheila. Sheila asked, how can I handle a situation when your child throws a tantrum at a public place, especially in the restaurant? People keep looking at us when our son starts shouting. I know he was overwhelmed and overstimulated, but how to calm him down when he doesn't want to stop? Thanks a lot. So in a Montessori approach to tantrums, we do try and sit with them to help them calm down. And then once they're calm, then we can, you know, address the thing that they had the tantrum about, whether something didn't go their way, or we can talk about it then. But basically, when they're having a tantrum, they've flipped their lid, as Dan Siegel says, where you can't access the prefrontal cortex. And so you're so emotional. So it's our role then to first help them calm down. And then once their prefrontal cortex is available, you might be able to explain why it didn't go the way they did. But in that moment, when you're calming down and you're in a public place, it can be really awkward. And it's not really great to disrupt a restaurant or somewhere like that. For a start, I don't know, it's really difficult to expect young children. This is a 2-year-old to sit in a restaurant. So if it's overwhelming, you could be like, I'm really sorry that you're having a hard time. And I would pick them up and take them out for a walk and, you know, calm down outside. And if they're pushing and pulling at you, like, yeah, I can see that. I see you're having a hard time, and I'm being as gentle as possible. We're going to go outside and we'll, you know, be able to have some space there to talk about it. If you have to do it in situ, then you will need to, you know, try and pacify both parties, the people who are in the restaurant, saying, I'm really sorry, my son's having a really hard time right now. He's really overwhelmed. And then trying to comfort the child as well, because, yeah, you're also interrupting, and we want to respect that they're in a restaurant and they're not expecting to be, you know, disturbed by a 2-year-old having a tantrum. So I try and do it in the way that's most respectful for everyone, really. So mostly that is probably to leave. But I know that sometimes in the supermarket, and your child's 4 years old and they're really strong and you can't move them, then you do your best to maintain as much face as you can. You smile, you stay calm when everyone else is not calm. And that's the best advice I can give on that. I actually also just thought of one more thing, going back to your getting your partner on board. And what I also like to do is to parents learn in different ways, right? So maybe you've talked to them, but actually sometimes telling a story about someone who they respect could also be helpful, like someone they work with or those kind of things. Or maybe they would listen to a podcast, or there's even the audio version of my book, or maybe sending an article. I have a newsletter. It's not just my things, but you know, maybe if they're a scientific kind of person, they might really appreciate a scientific aspect or an article about, you know, the effects of timeout or the effects of punishment on children. So keep looking at the person who you're wanting to give information to and what's going to resonate for them. So for someone who actually isn't so scientific, you might want to give them more a lighthearted, you know, explanation, a short article to get them interested, and then you can give them more deep information as they become more open to the idea. Okay. Beth asks, do you have some tips for how to approach car seat loading when on a tight time frame, such as when a parking lot is full and others are waiting, or perhaps if there is an appointment to get to? We try to give plenty of time for our 2.3-year-old, I guess that's 2 years, 3 months, to come to her seat on her own time whenever possible. But it seems that more and more lately, this is taking longer, and there are times when we simply must go. Yes, indeed. So I think that, like you say, like I think mostly we can go at their pace and it might take a little longer. And if it's really starting to be 15 minutes to get into the car, then it's a bit like a child who's dragging on bedtime. It's kind of actually like I'm probably being a bit wishy-washy here. I don't know if you know that phrase, but I'm not really being clear on what I'm saying. And getting into the car doesn't need to take 15 minutes because it's driving me crazy as well. So recognize that. But in general, like, yeah, if it takes them a little while to get into the seat and find the comfy spot that they want and that they have the book that they need and it takes a little while, let's do that mostly at their own pace and not speed them up. But then when you are in a hurry, I think the person I love following the most for this kind of thing is Janet Lansbury, and she has a podcast, Unruffled, and also a website. And I found a great article about car seat struggles because she really is so good at giving these kind and clear limits. So I think it's a really useful article. Some of the things that she says is kind of like you can empathize with them, like, oh, I know you didn't want to get into the car and I'm sorry I had to make you do it, and I know that that's upsetting. So you're kind of like empathizing with them that they didn't want to get into the car seat, and I'm sorry I had to make you do it, that was upsetting, you know. It really empathized with them, but you still are kind and clear and going forward, like, oh, there's people waiting and I wish we had lots of time. But again, reminding myself to use gentle hands, I'm putting on your car seat, yeah, you're really not enjoying that. And you can kind of Janet Lansbury talks about sports casting through it and explaining what's going on and how you're plugging in the seatbelt and that we're getting ready so that the other people can come. If you've got an appointment to go to, you could explain like, yeah, normally we can go much slower and today we're going to be at the appointment on time and we don't want to be late for the doctor. You know, it's not respectful to let them wait for us. Basically, you know, sometimes they are going to cry when we need to make them do things. And I think that most of the time when we're very respectful, they realize that we don't want to do it either, but that it's for safety. Then we're kind and clear and moving forward and doing our best to comfort them and still get our car out and of the way for another person or to get to our appointment on time. Even here in the Netherlands, most of the time you actually don't see many children melting down out of the house, but occasionally you'll see someone on their bike and their child's crying on their back, and you know, the parents just puts their hand back to pat them and say, you know, I see you're having a hard time. So it's not ignoring them, you know, their wails, it's acknowledging that it's difficult to leave and that it's rushing them, but it's also being really kind and clear, and also in the way that we're handling them as gently as possible. You can also give them a choice. I think that's another thing that Janet says in her article, is kind of like, would you like to climb into the seat yourself or would you like me to pick you up? And basically, I'm giving them a choice of two options, and they're the only two options that count. It's not that, you know, you can get in my seat and sit for a while and play in the front car seat. Okay, so I'll definitely link to Janet Lansbury's work as well so that you can find that if you're not already following her. And Claire, this will be the last one. Claire asks, how do you manage sibling conflict when the smaller child, age one, wants to be involved in everything his sister, age three, does, but in the process kind of ruins everything, resulting in anger and tears? So I completely can picture this, and I think many people with siblings would recognize it as well. And so for one, when the one-year-old's wanting to get involved, I try and set something up that they can be successful at. They're obviously interested in what the older one's doing, but it's not always successful. So how can I simplify this activity so that they can do their thing, but they don't interrupt their sister's work? That would be step one for me, is like seeing that they're interested and how can I make both of them successful? Again, it might be being clear on what's the rule for sharing in your house. So like, is it that the sister can have a turn and then the one-year-old can have a turn? Like, so that you can be clear in how you're mediating the situation. So you can say, oh, it looks like your sister wants to play with that all by herself. She's pulling it close to her and you look like you're really interested in doing it too. It will be available soon. Or, you know, then you can very kindly and calmly explain the two perspectives. No one's right, no one's wrong. The one-year-old's just interested and it's okay for the three-year-old to not want her baby brother or sister to want to interfere as well. Which leads me to the next thing, which would be like, I would always create a space where they can go to play when they don't want to have their stuff interfered with. So for a while, it might be at a dining table or somewhere up high. It might be in their room. It might be in a tent or, I mean, I love making just a cubby house out of some chairs and blankets and then you can pin up a sign and the sign can say private. And then you can point to the sign to the one-year-old and say, it says private. It says private. I think we better come back. Let's go and find something that we can do while your sister finishes playing with that. And maybe we can have a turn next. And then, you know, maybe if there's no way that we can separate the two of them, then we're going to help the younger one watch. Yeah, it looks like you really want to touch it. And she's really pulling it close. And so you might just say, yeah, we keep our hands on our laps. Yeah, it's really hard. You really want to touch that. Yeah, it looks like you're really interested. And then navigating that as best you can just by staying relaxed yourself. But I think physically making different areas or getting the one-year-old involved in a simpler version would probably be the best way to approach this. Okay, everyone, thank you so much for all your questions. I hope that you enjoyed that, even if they weren't your questions in particular, but that there's just lots of Montessori principles that came out. Again, yes, if you like these episodes, let me know so I know whether or not to include more of them. And I also would love to know, like, when you're listening to these podcasts, what are you doing? Like, I'm often preparing my classroom when I listen to podcasts. So shoot me a note, maybe take a photo of yourself. I had some really sweet photos. Someone was on a train and someone was cleaning and someone else was commuting on the train. And actually someone even said that they love London traffic when they have to listen to the podcast, which is very sweet. So I'd love to hear what you're up to while you're listening to this podcast. You can even screenshot where you are and note down any takeaways. And not only will I get to hear about what you're learning from the podcast, then someone who follows you might resonate for them. And we might be able to get more people on board with the Montessori approach and keep spreading, as I say, peace and positivity around the world. And what I love is it's just one family at a time, because you make changes in your home and then someone at the playground might notice that you're doing things a little differently and ask you about it. Or, you know, they might just be impressed. And like, I've heard so many people already say that listening to Trina and Eloise, for example, just or has already changed the way that they're thinking about parenting their child. So that's how we're going to change the world, is just by showing people that it can be done in a different way. So I think that's everything for today. I'm going to be back next Friday. And as I said, it's a conversation with Helene. She's a delight and she has some great takeaways, things that are really practical that I'm sure you'll be able to put into practice in your home too. Basically everything she learned from being in our Montessori playgroup and the things that they're still using today with Josie. And so until next Friday.
Thanks for joining me for the Montessori Notebook podcast. The podcast was edited by Luke Davis from FilmProv Media and podcast art by Hiyoko Imai. To find out more about me and my online courses, visit themontessorinotebook.com, follow me on Instagram at @themontessorinotebook, or pick up a copy of my book, The Montessori Toddler, from your local bookstore, Amazon, or where books are sold. It's also available as an ebook, audiobook, and has been translated into over 20 languages. I'll be back in a week with more Montessori inspiration, and in the meantime, perhaps you'll join me in spreading some more peace and positivity around the world.